Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Ohio gubernatorial candidates are set to square off in three debates this fall. Democrat Richard Cordray and Republican Mike DeWine meet for the first event next Wednesday at the University of Dayton. It's been a while since Ohio voters were treated to a gubernatorial debate. Joining us today is Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
It's great to be here.
Ohio politics and government reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning.
And Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back, Jim.
Good morning.
We've got three debates scheduled, the first September 19th, the second October 1st, and the final October 8th, which is actually, you know, almost a month before the election, 2 days before early voting begins, however. How do three debates, I mean, this is pretty good compared to the last election cycle when there were no debates. Joe Ingles?
Well, the last election cycle, there was no contest, really. I mean, I don't want to be mean, but, you know, Ed Fitzgerald in the last gubernatorial race was so far behind John Kasich that—
Who was the incumbent.
Who was the incumbent and was reelected. And so, you know, basically, if there was a debate, it was a chance for, you know, Kasich to slip up. And, you know, he was so far ahead without debating Ed Fitzgerald, he didn't need to. So, I mean, this time we're seeing a closer race, number one. So that's going to lead to more debates. But I also think the two people who are running, at least the two major candidates, Rich Cordray and Mike DeWine, they're both seasoned candidates. They've been down this road before. And I think that they feel confident, you know, just getting out there. And because they are so close, they really need to, you know, differentiate themselves in a debate.
But the math is that it's a close race, therefore they both have to show up.
Right. I mean, we've seen this on both sides of the aisle where strong incumbent candidates do not want to debate their challengers. And, you know, especially thinking of in Northeast Ohio, Marcia Fudge even has declined to debate her opponents in the past at the City Club, which is a pretty important, you know, locale.
A very established,
you know, venue for political speech. Right. It's kind of like, you know, if you're ahead, you know, and you go into this debate, you have a lot to lose. There's a chance for making a misstep, a chance that your opponent has a chance to become more known to the electorate and maybe get a few, you know, shots in on you. So I do think it's interesting that the last debate is, like you said, it's almost a month before Election Day.
But early voting.
Right. But yeah. I think that's something that in these last couple election cycles we've seen, it's more important to hit that early voting deadline because we do have, I mean, I just got my absentee ballot request mm-hmm. over the weekend and a lot of people did. And, you know, it, to see that and say, whoa, we are this close to the election that I'm going to, you know, have to do this, you know, mail this back if I want to, you know, absentee ballot. A lot of people do vote early and a lot of people still vote on Election Day. But in a race like this, that seems to be very close in all of the polling, those early votes are going to be important.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about three debates scheduled for the gubernatorial race in Ohio. Jim, what do you think about the three debates versus just one? I guess I was kind of surprised they agreed to three.
Well, three is kind of often a middle ground when you have one candidate often will say, oh, we'll just debate once. The other one suddenly throws out five or six and they end up with three.
Okay.
Three is generally a good number, in my opinion, just because mm-hmm. it allows you to get to a variety of topics throughout the three debates. And because there's only going to be two candidates on stage, you can really hone in. It won't be cluttered up by a whole bunch of people on stage who aren't going to get more than 3% of the vote. And so you really get to ask a wide range of questions over three debates. And frankly, if once those debates are over, you should have a good idea of where these two stand.
And they're pretty close together, so
right.
your memory is easier to refresh.
It's a lot easier, I think, as a voter to see the options in front of you mm-hmm. on the same stage at the same time, speaking, you know, right after each other. It's a lot easier, I think, visually and just all around to be able to differentiate the two.
What about the format? Now, there's a debate commission in Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference there? I mean, has that made a difference, do you think?
The debate commission is made up of a cross-section of all the media, the community groups, League of Women Voters. A lot of nonpartisan groups came together, and they developed this commission. And basically, the idea was that, you know, sometimes it's really hard to get candidates to debate because they perceive one, you know, venue or one, or not a venue, but a one group that's putting it on as being okay. biased or mm-hmm. whatever, right? So the idea was to get a nonpartisan group that represented a lot of people from around the state and put them together and let them come up with this debate commission. And I know the debate commission has one of the gubernatorial debates, and I think they would like to get some other debates, you know, maybe a U.S. Senate debate or something like that. But that's something that's worked in other states, these debate commissions, because they are truly more nonpartisan, and candidates seem to like them a lot.
And the organizations involved carry a lot of weight. They're not just, you know, I think, you know, candidates get a lot of calls from, you know, everything from like the local Rotary Club to, you know, major media outlets to do debates and attend events. And by consolidating, you know, media organizations, you know, educational institutions, these, you know, voter outreach groups, it's really putting a lot of weight behind like an invitation to a debate. And right. I think one of the hopes in this debate commission is to solve that problem that we were just talking about, where an incumbent or a front runner is reluctant to, you know, debate their opponent by saying, look, you know, we are nonpartisan. We are putting in a debate structure that is going to be fair for all candidates involved. And, you know, hopefully with our clout, you will take this invitation seriously and come and debate.
But do people watch the debates? Jim Siegel, do you think maybe this year, if it's a hotly contested race?
I don't know. It's always been a, you know, a debate about debates. Who actually watches them and whether they actually swing anybody's...
Well, maybe they do if they read the newspaper the next morning or read what the reports
yeah,
are.
Yeah, I think I would guess there's a lot more people who follow up the next day with newspaper, radio, and TV accounts of the debates than actually watch them live. Although these days, there's a lot more options available to watch them. You don't just have to be at home in front of your TV. I'm sure these debates will be streamed online.
Mm-hmm, right.
They'll probably be archived. You can watch them again if you need to. So there is a chance if you miss it the first time, I'm sure you can go back and catch it.
Well, and I think too, the way that a media operates today is that you'll see highlights on all of those different avenues that Jim was talking about on your TV news, but you'll also see the campaigns probably putting forward their highlights from the debates, and you know, the various media organizations will be showing clips of it again. So, I mean, it'll be very, I think, if, you know, I don't know, most people probably haven't put on their calendar these dates and plan to sit down and watch the whole thing. But I think that the effect of having the candidates on the stage, having to defend their positions to one another and to the audience and the moderators, I think that information will trickle out to the voters through a variety of ways.
Okay, and then this time we had, you know, I enjoyed, I think it was today's paper, Nate Bieler's cartoon about the two debating and how they're trying to out-nerd each other. That's starting to come through loud and clear that they're trying to be the nerdiest guys on the block. I mean, and I'm wondering how that plays.
That will be, I think, a challenge for these moderators.
Check out Nate Bieler's cartoon today. I think it was today's paper. Mm-hmm. Pretty funny. But does that affect interest in the race? I'm wondering.
I don't know. I think the nerds are kind of interesting. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a nerd. But, you know, I think if you look at a lot of our TV shows and stuff, a lot of the stars of the shows are nerds.
Yeah, that's
I
true.
Mean, you know.
I will say this will be the first governor's debate that we've had since we've really had Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, 8 years ago, Twitter was barely a thing.
Right.
And now it's obviously a huge thing. So you'll have a lot of folks in real time commenting on the debate as they do with a lot of other debates nationally, and
right.
And so that'll be a different, also another thing that can get people engaged in this maybe that hadn't done it before.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I also wanted to talk about voter turnout, but I think I'll take a call from someone who wants to talk about it as well. Gary in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Gary.
Oh, hi. I was just going to say, since we were have so many negative attack ads, or negative attack ad season, if you will. If the panel thinks that, you know, like negative attack ads and heavy rotation could cause less voter turnout because people end up getting disgusted by seeing all the slinging. Thank you.
Yeah. Gary, thanks for the question. So what about it? I mean, there has been a fair amount of negative ads, and it's only going to get worse, I predict.
Well, if you look at the presidential elections, it certainly hasn't dissuaded people from voting in those. We've seen bigger turnout, actually, and there's been a lot of negative ads. You know, I think the thing is that these negative ads, what they can tend to do is define the talking point for a voter. And you could get voters who hear something over and over and over and buy into it. And maybe that's not actually the most important thing. You know, when you sit down and you think, okay, now how does government affect my life and what do I want out of, you know, my leaders and that kind of thing, your list is going to be a whole lot different than what the 30-second ads are often talking about. So I think that's where these negative ads come in. Is they replay over and over, and they set talking points.
Well, they tend to work too, right?
Yeah,
well, if they didn't work, if they didn't work, they wouldn't run them. And I know people hate watching them, and they say they hate watching them. But it's, I mean, that's the bottom line. Folks running political campaigns don't do things intentionally that don't work. So as soon as people start getting turned off by negative ads and voting the other direction because of them, then you know you're going to keep seeing them. But I don't know that it has. I agree with Joe. I don't know that it has a real impact on turnout. Turnout tends to be more about, you know, how you're feeling about your party, your, you know, the country, the actual, you know, are you excited to get out there and vote based on other factors, I think, than just the ads.
I would say that it hasn't even gotten particularly nasty yet.
Yeah. I mean, no, it hasn't.
Sure there's more to come. I mean, yeah. Rich Cordray had his first negative ad out, I think, last week.
I didn't
and
see
it was,
that.
Yeah, it's not really that.
Not
bad.
That negative.
So, I mean.
I mean, Mike DeWine has already hit Cordray a couple times.
Yeah.
And Mike DeWine is notoriously negative campaigner.
Mm-hmm.
So that you expect a lot more from that. And I'm sure Cordray will fire back.
The closer it is, the tougher it's going to get. Absolutely. Jeff in Columbus, you wanted to talk about debates a little bit. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to find out more about the different forms and platforms they're going to have the debate available. When Gary Johnson was running for president, every time he did an interview or he gave a speech somewhere, he made it all public. Are any of the candidates doing that? And or is like I listened to a podcast called Ohio Town Hall, and they talk about different things going on in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there's going to be any show like that, or if you guys.
Is that the Joe Cornelius show on the Farm Bureau show?
The Farm Bureau show,
okay.
Yes.
So what you're asking, let me clarify, is whether there's going to be a place to go where you can see the candidates in action, including in the debates, right?
Not even see so much, where I could be able to download
to
the
hear
debate
it.
Itself.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think that the mm-hmm. debates will be...
Yes.
Yeah, I imagine they will. They're going to be televised.
Yeah.
They're going to be live streamed over the internet and able to be watched probably at a link later.
Mm-hmm. And I know the debate commission, the Ohio Debate Commission, has been talking about making those available so that you can even have, you know, possibly an app. Now, whether that will come about this year, because the debate commission's fairly new, whether they'll be able to get that this year. But, you know, I think they would like to have that kind of ready anytime, listen to it anytime kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you'd hope this stuff evolves over time. I don't know where we are with the debates this year, but it'd be nice to. Okay, if I want to watch the debate, but I'm interested in this specific topic, taxes.
Right.
I could click on a link that takes me to the question about or questions about taxes, and I can just listen to that. I'm hoping that at some point we get to that
I'd like to be able to compare between mm-hmm. debates, yeah. too, and go from topic to topic mm-hmm. and compare what did they say in the first debate versus the third. Although I mm-hmm. think the point was made as well that they'll get to a lot of different kinds of mm-hmm. topics because of three debates. Jeff, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. You are listening to our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guests, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR. News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. You have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We remember there was a lot of national attention on the 12th congressional district race on August 7th, that special election. It was called for Republican Troy Balderson after a couple weeks, I mm-hmm. think. Ergo, it was a very close race. Yes. What kind of attention can we expect in general? I mean, when it comes to the midterms in Ohio on a national level, is there any race that will attract that much attention again?
Not like that, yeah. No, because that was in August and there wasn't anything else going on, so right. It kind of stood by itself. Although I think that race will still attract attention in November, but not the kind of attention it had before.
In August, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a very close race. I think most of the groups that kind of rate how the races are playing out. You know, they had it at a toss up, and then once Balderson won, they kind of moved it to lean Republican. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely competitive enough that it's going to get attention. It's one of a handful now of races in Ohio that congressional races that are getting attention. The most of which may be being the district. I think it's the first district, Steve Chabot's seat. He's facing a serious challenge. That's probably the Democrats' best chance at a pickup in Ohio mm-hmm. is that seat. Mm-hmm. The 12th may be number two, although there's a couple other districts that have also been shifted toward the Democrats, mostly going from, you know, solid Republican to lean Republican kind of things, and giving the Democrats at least a puncher's chance of pulling some of these out, depending on how it goes. And in this race, in the 12th, I mean, Daniel Connor's got like almost, you know, 9 times the money,
right.
10 times the
right.
money on hand.
Are you surprised at that?
At Balderson? Yes, okay. Absolutely. I mean, there's no reason why a Democrat in that district should be outraising the Republican by that kind of amount.
I think he got a lot of outside money, too.
He did. Most of those contributions, I think, came from outside of Ohio. And also, while Balderson's war chest is considerably smaller, he got a lot of outside help from political action committees in the special. And I think either that night, election night, or the next morning, one of those groups, even in their statement congratulating Balderson on his win, said, you know, he's going to need to raise some cash on his own going into November.
Because there's more races to spread the
exactly,
money around.
Exactly. Right. And right. But yeah, 10 times, that's pretty incredible. And looking at, the numbers, he raised, Danny O'Connor raised about $4 million in that last period and $1.4 million after election night. So that was when he, had lost the election day tally by a slim margin, but hadn't conceded yet. And, you know, we've talked about that on the show in the past, why stay in? And the fundraising pleas did come out, help me hang on. I'm getting close. We might have to do a recount. And certainly that seems to have helped him there.
Mike DeWine is way ahead of Rich Cordray, though, on the other hand, in the gubernatorial race. In general, fundraising, is it going to heat up more? Well, we've got Barack Obama coming into Cleveland for Cordray,
right.
I think on this Thursday.
Yes.
And then Donald Trump Jr. is coming in this week for is it DeWine or is it?
I don't know.
DeWine and Renacci,
yeah.
I believe.
DeWine and Renacci, yeah. Right, who's mm-hmm. running against Sherrod Brown for the U.S. Senate seat.
I can tell you, I don't think that Donald Trump Jr. pulls the kind of weight that Donald Trump does.
Okay.
President Trump. We saw that in the last election. There were a lot of times where the president's kids came in or, you know, and it you had a handful of people there. It wasn't like Donald Trump, but...
They're pretty effective surrogates for him. I mean, people will show up to see the Trump kids.
But not in the numbers and not in the...
Not like the giant rallies.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get the scads of people out there screaming about walls and, you know, the things that they do in the pageantry, if you will, that we see in those rallies with President Trump. That is never, at least in all the rallies I've attended with his children or, you know, surrogates, it has never been like that.
And Laura, along those lines, Laura Trump is going to be in Northwest Ohio next week, so...
For Mike DeWine.
For Republicans.
For Republicans in general. Mm.
Yeah.
And what about Barack Obama coming out the way he has, coming out swinging in this past week now, which is kind of unusual for a former president to do that. But I think, as he said, unusual times call for unusual behavior, I guess. I'm paraphrasing. But how do you think it's going to play?
I think Democrats love it because you hear them all the time. Democrats will say, you know, we miss Barack Obama. We need a leader like Barack Obama. And they really did love, you know, when he was in office, he had a lot of support. So I think that whole group that liked Obama is going to be enthused about Rich Cordray by extension. Mm. But, you know— aren't they already voting for Rich Cordray?
Well, it's more like a get out the vote enthuse, light a fire under them kind of a thing, isn't it? When a person like that comes out,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. I mean, the Democrats really they like to see the contrasting style of a Barack Obama giving a speech versus a Donald Trump speech. They think that they can use that to their advantage by putting that up together. I don't know if that's I don't know how true that is, but that seems to be what they're banking on, that his style of talking about hope and bringing everyone together, which contrasts a lot with President Trump's style, is going to be one that helps energize their folks even more.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and it is our weekly reporter roundtable. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The race for attorney general is getting contentious, apparently, over that shuttered electronic classroom of tomorrow issue. Jim, you wrote last week about Democrat Steve Dettelbach claiming if elected, he would focus on ethics and accountability. How much is ECOT going to play into the conversations? And is it just the attorney general's race or maybe the auditor's race as well?
It's going to be both. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's going to be the governor's race as well. Basically, Republicans running in all those races that have connections to the ECOT situation, and the Democrats are going to try to exploit that and make issue of it. Dettelbach, in the attorney general's race running against Dave Yost, the current state auditor, has definitely made a huge issue of ECOT, saying that Yost did not do enough to try to catch this, basically saying, you know, this is a fraud scheme, and you're the auditor, and you didn't catch this. Now Yost will say that he didn't, his audits were based off of what the Department of Education was asking for at the time when it came to login durations and other things for students, mm-hmm. and so that was not his job to go outside of those parameters. But some would say that he seemed to be more aggressive when he went after the Columbus Public Schools over their data scrubbing scandal than he was when. Mm-hmm. When he went after ECOT. Again, there's some truth to that, maybe some exaggeration, but it's definitely going to be an issue, and it's something that Yost Keith Faber, who's running for auditor, Mike DeWine and John Husted on the Republican ticket are all tied into the ECOT situation in certain ways. And Democrats think they can make an issue of this and turn it into a benefit for them.
Hmm. Ed, there's been skepticism, though, about whether they can achieve that, Joe Ingles, that it's too complicated. People don't know enough about ECOT, like versus, say, the CoinGate thing back from the 90s.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that's a matter of how they're going to define it. I mean, it can be defined in an elevator speech for certain, but we just haven't been hearing that so far. And I think, you know, one of the key things is I noticed there was an ad out locally about, and I believe this was in the O'Connor race, actually, O'Connor-Balderson race. There was an ad that said, this many tax dollars was taken away from your local school district. And when they made it local, people were, it was on social media, and people were commenting, they were livid, they were upset. You know, when they made it like real and it's coming out of your school,
it's
and your
a pocketbook
pocket,
issue.
Yeah. Then people pay attention. Hmm. But you're right. ECOT has also, if you talk about it in these, you know, the way we're talking about it, it could be just glossed over.
Hmm. Yeah, that is true. I mean, once you because of the way Republicans have set up school funding and set up charter school funding in particular, instead of directly funding charter schools, they subtract it off the bottom lines
of each
public school district.
Right.
So that does open up them to this argument that if there was fraud at ECOT, then that was coming right out of the budgets of your local school districts. And they have been meticulous going around the state pointing out the so-called cost to these local districts. Again, some of this is not exactly framed, in my opinion, in a completely honest way, but it's framed. It's enough that it gets them the message out that this came out of the local districts, and that you should, this is why you should care.
And it's an ongoing issue. These things have not been resolved fully yet. Let's see, Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ann. My question was kind of a lead off of what you mentioned earlier about who's watching the debates. I was just curious, your two guests that are, you know, reporters and they talk to a lot of people, are they meeting or talking to people who are undecided? I know Joe Ingles did a story, I think it was maybe the 2008 campaign, about undecided voters, and are there really any out there, or are they just faking it? Or something to that.
I like that for a headline. Yeah. That's a good headline there.
Well, all right. So, are you talking to voters yet? Is that something that you're up doing now that we're past the Labor Day?
Honestly, I haven't really talked to a lot of voters yet. I'm kind of giving it a break. I was waiting for the campaigns to kind of heat up, but I'm sure I will be talking to voters.
I can tell you, and I haven't either for pretty much the same reasons that Joe just gave. It feels, just now I'm like, okay, we've got some time. We're heading in, and I think this is now when most people are paying attention. Usually,
this is start when you go into the pumpkin show, and start when you're going to those kind of
right.
Events
you're getting and we're actually getting closer to it.
Thing,
I just have found that over the years when you run election related stories in like May and June, after the primary, well in advance of the general, not many people are paying attention,
right.
And those stories are often forgotten by the time that you get to election day, unless some piece of them ended up in a campaign ad. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I did read a story in the Toledo Blade over the weekend from their political reporter, Liz Skalka, and she went to a bar to talk to younger voters, people in their 20s and 30s, mm-hmm. to find out what their feelings were. And pretty much across the board, they were not enthusiastic about voting or told her that they weren't going to vote, and that they hadn't really even heard much about the election or the candidates or their positions. So I think that's probably, it was very targeted to younger voters, but I think that's probably a good reflection of kind of where we're at.
Yeah, people just don't tend to engage much in a midterm election until we get closer within 30 days is when they really start to pick it up, but maybe a little earlier. But yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of folks. I mean, there's some folks out there who probably, I'm sure, have made up their mind on who they're going to vote for, but I don't know that there's a whole lot of people who are sitting around doing much research right now and trying to decide between DeWine or Cordray.
There was a lot of millennial excitement revolving around Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. in 2016. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pain and frustration associated with the kind of the banishment of Bernie and the elevation of Hillary Clinton to the nomination to be the nominee. How much do you think that plays out in 2016 midterms? Are they still disenchanted, frustrated, going back to really back to the old, you know, apathetic? And this is, of course, present company excluded. Anybody out there listening right now who falls into that category, that demographic, but it is a kind of a known quantity.
You know, I saw that a little bit in the primary in the mm-hmm. Democratic side. Some frustration with Cordray on some of his positions, especially concerning guns, mm-hmm. and maybe some dissatisfaction that he's not as far to the left as they would like. But I mean, look, both in Cordray and I think you kind of see that a little bit with DeWine as well, with some more conservative Republicans. I mean, both of these guys are, you know, pretty middle of the road as far as where their parties are at right now.
What about the Trump effect for Republican candidates going forward? I mean, the midterms are usually seen as a vote for the president, up or down. Is it going to be an issue for some of them?
I think every time he comes to Ohio, I think the Democrats use it as a rally cry. You know, it's like, look over here. This is what it's about. If you want someone who can get him out of office, because, you know, if we flip the Congress and flip everything, we can, you know, maybe get him out of office. I think they're using that. And every time he comes, they kind of, you know, go after that point of view. As far as, you know, the Republicans, I'm not sure. If you look at that Balderson race, O'Connor race, did Donald Trump help or hurt Balderson? I'm not sure. And it was such a mixed message, because you had Donald Trump supporting Balderson, but you also had John Kasich supporting Balderson. And those are two different
polar opposites, as far as the Republican Party's
right.
concerned. Yeah.
So I don't think anything. I didn't see coattails in that race. Let's put it that way. Although I think President Trump immediately took credit for it or something.
I know there is concern about how he's the Trump effect, particularly in the suburbs. Suburban women, especially mm-hmm. The suburb. Like I wrote a story recently about there's three Republican held seats in Franklin County in the state legislature that Democrats are very hopeful that they can pick up, and a lot of it dealing with the fact that Hillary Clinton won all three districts last time by double digits, and that Donald Trump right now in those areas is polling terribly. Danny O'Connor won really big in those areas in the special election. So there's a thought that will also, you know, Democrats are hoping that they'll see those kind of things materialize in suburban Cleveland, Akron as well, and maybe in Cincinnati. They're telling me that they're seeing good numbers, that they're seeing some numbers even in races that they didn't think they'd be competitive in that are all of a sudden close. In some of those types of areas. So that's where it's possible that's where a Trump factor may play in, at least to help Democrats. Now, he may help Republicans in some of the more rural areas, or maybe out east, Youngstown and down the river. That'll be interesting to see if he continues to play well out there.
Hmm. We will be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us from Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Dispatch reporter Jim Siegel, and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Last week, Columbus City Schools canceled classes because of heat. The issue of air conditioning in classrooms, therefore, has sparked state lawmakers to action. You know, is this one of those?
Has it really? Well, I don't think it has. No.
Well, there's three bills.
By the time
ideas.
By the time they get back,
exactly. That was my
point. It's going to be cold.
It's going to be cold again.
And no, yeah. Everyone will have forgotten about the, you know, 3 or 4 days that we had an issue in parts of Ohio mm-hmm. here.
I think so too.
Yeah, I mean, this is not. I mean, look, that's money. And that's now that, you know, the state's been building a lot of buildings through its facilities commission,
right?
Over the years, and those buildings have air conditioning, but there's still a lot of districts out there that haven't come up on their turn hasn't come up, or they mm-hmm. kind of passed over the money, and they haven't hit it yet. And then, you know, big urban districts like Columbus, I mean, they've got a few they've got some buildings with air conditioning, mm-hmm. but not. Not a lot of them, and so it's, you know, and but this really hasn't been an issue. I mean, I don't want to get into a climate change debate here, but but I mean, look, you really don't usually see 85 to 90 degree temperatures, you know, hitting after everybody comes back to school like this, yeah. And high humidity. I mean, it's
back
this...
in the olden days, we used to go back to school after Labor Day.
Right.
Of course, this occurred. After Labor Day.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, so, that argument, I think, is seeing that too, and I was like, no. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, like Jim said, you know, the state, when they build a new school, those will have it. That's about 1,200 schools that I think have been built in the last 2 decades. Yeah. But if you're trying to retrofit an old school with central air, that is a huge HVAC expense. I know some schools.
Is it the prudent expenditure?
Right.
Of,
and
of
when you've got a budget
funds, yeah.
And you're it's public dollars, you know, what is the best use for that money? Is it going to be, you know, if you have to, it's a couple days out of school, but you're spending that money on educational materials or on hiring faculty, you know, that may be a more justifiable expense than, you know, going into your building and trying to, you know, put expensive air in. I did see, you know, some reports of some schools that when they have like an HVAC issue, that they need to fix for like heating, for example, then they will put in the air because it's not that much of an extra cost. But as mm-hmm. far as like a priority
and retrofitting an entire
right,
school,
as
yeah.
far as a priority and the cost, I mean, those are things that the schools are having to evaluate. But I see the frustration as a parent, like to keep have your kid home. And a lot of the, you know, some of these kids are going to homes that don't have air conditioning either.
Exactly. And food.
Right.
You know,
right.
There's a lot of things in play
right.
when they call off school in the winter or whenever they right. call off school, right. there's some kids that means they're not going to get two meals that day.
Exactly.
And some of these classrooms, especially in these older buildings, you know, they don't have functioning windows a lot yeah. of times for safety concerns because they don't, you know, maybe they're on a second level. You know, they're hot. They're not a good environment for a student to be learning.
Right.
Well, I remember the school that I went to in middle school had these big old windows and they used to have big, huge fans that you could put in the windows. I haven't seen a fan like that in years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like they were pretty cool, actually. We didn't sweat in, a, you know, 85, 90 degree heat in those rooms. I don't remember that. And I think there are other things that made a middle schooler sweat other than heat. But, yeah. you know, but it was just I think we've gotten away from that, you know, and I think people are seeing air conditioning as a must-have feature versus a luxury over the years. And now it's, you know, because it's so common everywhere, mm-hmm. that leads into this discussion.
And today it is 65 degrees.
Today is a typical school weather kind right, of a day, a fall right. weather day. But it is going to get back up into the 70s and 80s, so... Hold on to your hats. Boy, I'm glad the rain ended, though.
Yeah, I am,
that
too.
That was bleak. Just throw in some ash. We're talking end of days.
It was raining on my way over here, yeah. so
oh,
I don't
was
know.
It really?
I don't know about that.
Oh, it was raining and sunshine when I was yeah. on my way over, so, you know, it just...
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I wonder if state lawmakers are talking about the climate. And, it, you know, regardless of the whole climate issue, we got a lot of – I mean, there are changes and there are infrastructure changes that need to be made or at least be thought about to prepare for change. And I'm wondering in some states there are committees in the legislature assigned to – climate change issues and infrastructure in Florida, New York, that kind of a thing. They're thinking about these. They're commissions.
Well, not in Ohio.
Not
I
in
mean,
Ohio.
You know, in Ohio, we don't really have that kind of. But, you know, I think, I mean, they do some do talk about climate change, but it has not been. We've seen more of an emphasis on the, you know, the other direction in the legislation that's been put out there, at least.
How so?
We've seen, you know, with the electricity providers, you know, kind of easing back, you know, not requiring the regulations and that direction. And we've seen that nationally, too. But a lot of times you just don't hear the state level. I don't hear any of the lawmakers really, at least the Republican lawmakers out there, banging the climate change drum.
Well, I mean, look, our current legislature, the ones that put a freeze on the renewable energy standards,
right.
I think, you know, that's not a priority.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they don't have the ocean lapping at their doorstep like they do in Florida.
We don't have cities that are about to drop into the ocean.
Right.
No, but we have a green Lake Erie that is
swallowing
up everything because of the algae problem.
Right.
And
that's the
right.
problem.
Right, the runoff.
And that has not been
water.
Not been dealt with.
Nope.
To any major extent, they cannot seem to come
to a resolution to that.
No, because that makes people mad. I mean, if you're not going to fix a problem that big without making people mad,
that's right.
And so they're trying to find these kind of, you know, moderate, middle of the road kind of solutions, and it just, you know. I don't think it's going to have a lot of impact until they really start cracking down on what is getting poured into the lakes. And,
yeah.
Right. All right. So I wanted to turn to Planned Parenthood. They've launched a super PAC in Ohio. That obviously means they have some things some points to make. It's said that this is going to be the organization's, quote, largest electoral plan in history. They want to raise $1.5 million. Why this election cycle? Why now? Jackie Borchardt.
Well, I mean, look at the last 8 years since John Kasich's been in office. They've signed some 20 different.
I don't know.
My count's at about 20-ish abortion restrictions.
Okay.
And we've seen, you know, the number of clinics, abortion clinics in Ohio halved. Two may be closing by the end of the year. And Ohio has kind of emerged as a leader among states in abortion restriction language, and being able to get these bills passed. We're a state that other states look to for where they can find model legislation and new ideas to further restrict abortion. So it makes a lot of sense that Planned Parenthood is coming in here trying to raise a bunch of money and influence elections because everyone has seen how Ohio can make a difference on that subject.
I agree. I think they're seeing, too, that there is some pushback right now. There's some buy-in to their point of view. And, you know, people are questioning it. But, you know, it's still you look at the polls that they put out there. This is so contentious. And the abortion issue is contentious. Even sometimes the birth control issue can be pretty contentious. And so, you know, by them getting in there, at least they're competing with the Right to Life folks and, you know, that already are in there. My question is, you know, why didn't they do that years ago before they lost so much ground if that was the, you know.
I think they also see an opportunity in this election. It's open seats where they can really – you know, make an impact. You know, we were just talking about 2014 and how that was not really a contest. You don't really want to put your money on a bet where you're probably going to lose, right? You want to put your money where you think you can make an impact. So, and if you look at some of these bills that have been passed over the last, you know, 7 years, look how many, like, Planned Parenthood has sued the state over, you know, the funding. There was moving them to the back of the line for federal, you know, family planning dollars and TANF money. There are also, I believe, in the lawsuit involved with the ban on abortions for Down syndrome, once a Down syndrome diagnosis has been made. So, you know, when you think about that, they're spending a lot of money already on suing the state for some of these things. You could make like a cost analysis that maybe it's better to try to get people elected who are more favorable to your cause than to try and sue them later in court.
And we saw just this past week in the Kavanaugh hearings, he made some sort of statement about birth control and equated it to abortion, and the Planned Parenthood folks were right on top of that.
They called it right one of the pill, birth control pill. Mm-hmm. He equated it to anti-abortion pill. Right. So what about Mike DeWine and Rich Cordray. I mean, is this going to be a bone of contention between them? Mike DeWine obviously opposes abortion rights. Richard Cordray supports.
Well, I think for voters where this is a really important issue for them, I don't think they're not like wavering between the two candidates. I don't think mm-hmm. that this is an issue where they need to further define themselves. I think their records, you know, are pretty much speak for themselves, and they've both been vocal about where they stand on this issue.
Yeah, this is one of the clear-cut issues, really, for them, because, I mean, they're a mile apart on these issues, really.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, you know, there's Planned Parenthood starting up this PAC now. I think consistently, it seems, the polls have shown that the majority of folks in Ohio and nationally oppose a ban on abortion. Now most people do support restrictions, but most people do oppose a ban. So Planned Parenthood, I think, has a, you know, if you believe the polls, has a majority on its side to some degree. However, the problem that they've always had, that Democrats have always had with this issue, is that the side that opposes abortion rights is much more engaged and mm-hmm. much more likely to make it a single issue for their support.
Right.
The number of folks who say that they are anti-abortion, those folks are very unlikely to vote for you if you are pro-choice. Mm-hmm. But it's not so much the other way. And so otherwise we would see very different results in a lot of elections. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting that maybe the Planned Parenthood is trying to tap into this a little more, get some money out there, and maybe try to drive this message a bit more and remind people, hey, if you do support abortion rights to some degree, that you may want to step up and start paying attention. And here's who you need to look at.
Mm-hmm. So we have a few minutes left, and we have a week ahead of us. What are you guys looking forward to covering this week, Jackie Borchard?
Well, I think I'm trying to think. You know, we found out last week that the Senate's not going to be back for a couple weeks, so I think we've got a couple more kind of election, focused time here. I've seen already some down ticket candidates have some events scheduled for this week, so they're starting to try to get their message out. So I'll be looking to see more on that.
What's the score, Joe Engels?
Well, I'll give a plug to it. We're going to be doing a pretty comprehensive opioid series coming up, and this is a good time to get that out there. We're going to be working on that. It won't be this week that we'll have that finished, but it will be a look at an extension of what we did last year.
And what are you going to be looking at?
Well, we've got a lot of, you know, last year we did a whole half hour on opioids and a half hour show, and you could barely scratch the surface, really.
Exactly.
You know, because it's such a huge problem. So we're looking at some different aspects of it this year. And, hopefully people will watch it and learn from it and listen to it and learn from it. Because there are so many, you just can't even get a grasp on how many people are, everyone's affected by this. Everyone is affected by it. Because either you have a friend or a family member, mm-hmm. and if you don't have a friend or a family member, you're paying money and lost productivity and lost money. Basically, you're losing money because the state is having to invest so much money and not nearly meeting the need even at that. So, you know, it's very comprehensive, and I think people will be interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Jim Siegel.
Well, the governor's going to sign the payday lending bill today.
Yeah. Wow, so, finally.
Yeah.
Yeah. He signed it already.
Well,
he signed it already.
Okay,
this is just the, ceremonial.
The ceremonial.
Pomp and circumstance.
Get some photos. And
mm-hmm. Right. What's interesting, my colleague Daryl Rowland pointed this out in his column, that most of the folks who will be there will be Democrats. For the elected officials,
because
they support it, and they don't see any as much political downside to appearing with Kasich and appearing on the side of cracking down on payday lenders. I guess.
Well, of course, you know, there's this ongoing investigation of former Speaker of the House mm-hmm. Rosenberger. Mm-hmm. Who's now resigned amid this FBI look into his dealings with payday lender lobbyists.
Yeah, and we're all kind of waiting to see what transpires from that. I have no idea. The feds just don't talk much about what they're going to do and when. So we're waiting to see.
All right. Well, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, thanks for joining us,
yeah,
as always.
It's always great to be here.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.